That's Jimmy Stein. I'm Clint Lamb, and this is the Bama Online YouTube channel. Jimmy, another week of spring practice down. It's Monday. A lot going on. It is Monday, right? I'm not crazy.
It's Tuesday. Slightly crazy. Slightly crazy. I think if you miss by a day, that's not too bad. I don't think that's going to alarm any psychiatrist.
I got to be honest. As I was saying Monday, I was like, "Whoa, I don't know that it's." But what I didn't want to do was then pivot and say, "No, it's Tuesday. I'm wrong." And then you'd be like, "No, it's Monday." So here we go. It's going to be one of those types of days. We could start this thing over, and no one would ever know that I just did that. We're not going to. We're going to. I mean, it's a busy week. There's a ton going on between basketball. Alabama's in the Final Four. Charlie Potter went out to L.A., covered Alabama out there in the Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight. They get to their first ever Final Four. He's continuing to be very basketball heavy this week, which is very understandable. But you and I, we're staying in our lane, you know, as much as we possibly can with the football stuff. And we're going to have, you know, some offensive, you know, coaches and players. We're also going to have some defensive coaches and players. There's going to be a Saturday scrimmage. The first scrimmage was on Thursday. This upcoming scrimmage is going to be on Saturday. So there's a lot to look forward to, and that's exactly what we are going to talk about. You know, so let's just go ahead and dive in. Jimmy, we'll start with the offensive line just because there's a lot of – I've been getting a lot of messages. Some people have zero concern whatsoever. They know that it's the spring. These things are going to work itself out. There are others, you know, with the uncertainty at the two tackle positions. You lose J.C. Latham. Caden Proctor's currently not on campus. That's a concern for fans, but then you throw in some uncertainty at center, and right now there's a million different ways that this could work out, so we're not going to speculate or assume too much. I don't think that that's healthy, but it's more of a just in case, you know, let's talk, you know, some scenarios and whatnot, just, you know, how things stand at that center position. You obviously got your two guard spots locked up with Tyler Booker and Jane Roberts, but let's start with center. And let's also talk about tackle. What are your thoughts on the offensive line as they really get into their first full week of spring, right? Because, I mean, this is the first time they've had three practices.
Yeah, that's right. First time they've had three practices in a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and then they'll scrimmage on Saturday. So it's the most full week of practices since spring practice started. So we should have a pretty big week in terms of some info and intel and a lot to discuss. You know, that offensive line, you mentioned some people aren't concerned at all. I would be concerned about the people that aren't concerned at all because I'm a pretty optimistic guy, but I have some concerns about the offensive line, and I will all the way into the fall. Now, at the same time, people that are literally losing sleep over it are going too far. You know, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it, but I do think there are legitimate concerns. The irony to the whole thing is, offensive guard, in my opinion, is either the best or second best position on the entire team. I mean, because you've got two, frankly, All-American candidates at both the guard spots, I think. I think Tyler Booker is a candidate to be the best guard in college football, a candidate. Jane Roberts is also a candidate to make things like All-SEC and contend to kind of move his name up NFL draft boards, to be honest. So guard's great, but you're asking about center and tackle because – that's where the questions are. And center looked like, you know, a strength about a week ago. And now that's up in the air again. Like Clint said, we're not going to speculate because it's just too early. There needs to be more information. It's just dangerous to speculate one way or the other. But the last two practices, as has been reported by BOL, by Tim Watts, site publisher, and Charlie Potter, you know, Parker Brailsford hadn't been out there the last two practices. We're not going to assume he won't be out there again, and we're not going to assume that he'll be out there Wednesday. We'll just say for, you know, James Brockermeyer is out there, and he's been one of the stories of the spring. There's no question that's true, and that's going to lead to a question I have for Clint, who wrote a great piece on the offensive line this week that was really interesting. But, you know, the question for me is, if Brockermeyer is the center and he may win the position outright, or he may be the last guy standing. We don't know. But if Brockermeyer's a center, is that going to be okay? And I think so far the answer this spring is it might be okay. again, that's another thing where if you're too optimistic, you're not really, I don't think, grounded in reality. I mean, he's a junior that hasn't played a snap with the ones in 3 full years on campus. So it's a little out there, I think, to be super confident about it. But at the same time, I talk all the time about what coaches say. You know, a lot of people just think it's all coach speak. I don't. I think when the offensive line coach or the offensive coordinator is asked about a player, there's a certain, for lack of a better word, politeness. You know, they're not going to talk about a kid's not good or throw him under the bus or make the kid stressed out. It's going to be generally positive. But what I tell people all the time when they're looking at these quotes, okay, understand what a coach has to say because that's how polite society works. And then realize if the coach went further. And I've seen Nick Sheridan and Coach Kapp go further than needed in giving Brockermeyer a lot of slaps on the back. I mean, they've been very complimentary of Brockermeyer. They don't have to do that, but they have been. That tells me that Brockermeyer is a real story of the spring. We shouldn't be surprised when you get all the way to year four before an offensive lineman is good. One story I learned this offseason that I repeat often because I think it's just a great example. Kirk Ferentz at Iowa, ironically, because we're going to talk about an Iowa offensive tackle in this show. Kirk Ferentz, who's one of the great offensive line head coaches out there. Ferentz was asked, or I forget what the question was, but Ferentz mentioned he's had 3 different offensive linemen at Iowa never play one snap with the first team until they were fifth-year seniors. 3 different starters in his time at Iowa became starters as fifth-year seniors who had never seen the field before. All 3 had substantial careers in the NFL. That is telling us all we need to know about the developmental nature of this position. That's not going to be the case at running back. You're never going to hear that same story about a running back. But you will hear it about offensive linemen. You'll hear it about maybe tight ends, maybe even defensive linemen, but definitely offensive linemen. It's just a developmental spot. No one should be shocked that Brockermeyer wasn't ready to play in years 1, 2, or 3, and now he is. That is almost typical of the position. So I'm optimistic about Brockermeyer, but at the same time, you have to be grounded because we haven't seen it yet, and he hasn't played a snap with the ones, and he's been there for 3 years. So I'm a little bit show me on it, but also optimistic about the center spot. Behind him is just going to be freshmen for now, whether it's Joseph Iannotta. I think William Sanders is seeing some snaps at center. I think Rock Montgomery has played some center. I think Casey Poe is a guy they could look at center. I think if things got desperate in their eyes, you could see Olas Allen play a little center. But for now, it's Brockermeyer 1 and Iannotta with the 2s, maybe Sanders with the 3s. I think it's James Brockermeyer for now, and then we'll revisit this next week. And whether we're talking about the Washington guy or not next week, who knows?
Yeah, I think that you have a great feel for it. And like we typically do, we're kind of aligned in our thinking. My thing with Brockermeyer is that he was a part of that 2021 offensive line haul that Alabama had. You know, you had J.C. Latham. You had Tommy Brockermeyer, the top 2 tackles in the country. You had Terrence Ferguson. You had Jaden Roberts. And then you had James Brockermeyer. Obviously, Tommy Brockermeyer is gone. You know, J.C. Latham, gone. Terrence Ferguson, gone. But that other guy, who was actually the lowest rated of the group, was Jaden Roberts, who was viewed as a third-string guy, or was at least that's where he was in the pecking order last year until he was thrust into a starting position or a starting role, and he thrived, and he never gave it up. And the guy, that's one reason Terrence Ferguson's no longer on the roster. So, you know, who's to say that James Brockermeyer can't do something similar? Now, I understand he's a year later, but, you know, injuries didn't plague Alabama at center like they did at guard. So the opportunities weren't necessarily there for them. Another thing, and it's something that we've talked about, is the size. And the fact that he was 6'3", 285 pounds. When you have a 360-pound tackle or a couple of 360-pound tackles, and that's by design, or at least we think that that was by design, then when you got a guy who's almost 100 pounds lighter than that, at center, that's not ideal. Seth McLaughlin continued to pack on weight. He was once considered a little bit light for the position. That was how things were structured with last year's offense. And I think that the size of Brock Urmyer was viewed as a hindrance. It is no longer going to be viewed that way. Obviously, they want to get him as big as possible. They didn't prefer that Parker Brelsford be 6'2", 275 pounds. If they could get that movement, that athleticism, and he could put on a healthy amount of weight and get to 300 pounds, I'm sure that would be ideal. But it's not a necessity. The movement and the athleticism is so much more critical at that position than being big and being able to move people, just because of the way things operate. Now, it's going to look a little bit different in the SEC, and I want to, you know, make sure I continue to reiterate that, because it's not going to be exactly what you saw at Washington. There's going to be tweaks, but that's an important aspect of this. The other thing that I think is important is how much the coaching staff has gone out of its way to talk about how quickly Brock Urmyer has picked up this offense. The football IQ is there. He understands things. He's been able to pick this up. And so any advantage that Parker Brelsford may have had, or we thought he might have, the quicker Brock Urmyer picks up this offense, the smaller that advantage becomes. And who's to say what Brock Urmyer can be in this offense once that's happened?
You answered what was really my question. I mean, I had a question for you, and I should have ended my segment with a question, but you answered it. It was a perfect segue, and my question was really that. I'm speaking in hypotheticals here, but it, you know, the last staff, clearly everybody listening to this knows this the program really well, or you wouldn't be listening. So everybody that's listening to this knows there was a concerted effort last year to get really big. That's what they wanted. That's, and don't blame it all on Wolford. You know, there was an OC, Tommy Reese, and then there's his boss, Nick Saban. It was a program decision to get big on the offensive line. And in my opinion, it's because they wanted to become a run-the-ball offense last year, a run the darn ball, as they say. And I think that was kind of a major goal of last year's offense. They wanted to be big. So when you want to be big, and one of the backup centers on scholarship is 275 pounds, maybe 280, if he's wearing wet clothes, and I'm talking about James Brockermeyer, let's be honest, they probably weren't going to give him much of a chance. I mean, they wanted to be big. Why would they say, hey, why don't we audition the smallest offensive lineman we have on the roster? No, they were trying to be big. Latham said, hey, coach, I'm 365. What do you think? And they're like, perfect. Can you get to 370? That same guy's not going to say, oh, but put in the 280-pound center. So that leads to my question. I mean, don't you think, or doesn't it appear to you that Brockermeyer may not have been given much of a shot over size alone, whereas the new staff, whose center only weighed 275 pounds and made all-star teams, when Brockermeyer was there at 280, they're like, oh, cool, this guy's 5 pounds bigger than our other guy.
Yeah, and from what we've heard, back when this was prior to Kalen DeBoer getting brought over, this was, you know, when Seth McLaughlin chose to enter the transfer portal, Nick Saban had not retired yet. The initial reaction from Bama Online's Andrew Bone was to report that Brockermeyer had gotten into that 295 range. And so he's closing in on 300 pounds. Man, that's kind of what you want. In a Kalen DeBoer offense, I would say 295 to 305, anywhere in there, it would probably be ideal. Now, it's like Coach Cap has said, it's about getting guys as big as humanly possible while not having that added size or mass hinder their ability to move and hinder their athleticism. And so that plays into this equation as well. When I say between 295 and 305, that's me making some assumptions, which they are assumptions, but that would be kind of the max weight on a 6'3 frame for a guy like Brockermeyer, who's built like he is, that would still allow him to maintain what athleticism he already has. And we've talked about the importance of football IQ at that position. So just a tip for people, when you're hearing an offensive line coach or an offensive coordinator or a head coach talk about a center, one of the aspects you want to hear is football IQ. And that is not one of the top things that we've heard about Brockermeyer every time someone's been, you know, he's been brought up to anybody. And I think that that's pretty key. That does not mean Parker Brelsford is not coming back. That does not mean that Parker Brelsford won't be in the competition. That didn't mean that Parker Brelsford won't be the starting center for Alabama in 2024. like we said, that's way too premature at this point. It could go in a number of different directions. We're going to let that play out, but we're talking specifically Brockermeyer and what he brings to what I still view as a center competition until we're told otherwise.
Yeah, I like that. And one thing, man, people have a tendency, I think, to view things as right and wrong instead of in this gray area or up for debate. And what I would say about, I was just talking about how Alabama last year wanted the offensive lineman to be big, grow big, and be big. And guess what? It produced a first-round offensive tackle because J.C. Latham, me and Clint are draft nicks. We watch all the draft stuff. We read every mock draft. We know all the draft news. We look at it every day. J.C. Latham is a lock first-round pick, even though last year at Alabama, he weighed in the 365-pound range playing right tackle. Now, he's lost weight down to in the low 340s to prepare for the NFL. But my point is, last year, what Alabama did on the offensive line, for those of you frustrated with it and thought it was all wrong, that's fine. I have that opinion, and the results are the results. But didn't hurt J.C. Latham in terms of the NFL. He's going to go in the first round. You know who else produced a first-round tackle in this upcoming draft? Kalen DeBoer. You know, the system at Washington with Ryan Grubb, now Nick Sheridan, Scott Huff coaching the offensive line. Washington's tackle last year is also a first-round lock. He's not going to go as high as Latham, and he's not as heavy. He's, in fact, maybe even more athletic. But guess where he's going in the NFL draft? In the first round. And that's all people need to know about how many different ways there is to skin the cat, as they say. It's not one size fit all. It's not one philosophy is right and another is wrong. It's just the most important thing is that you create a scheme and a plan and recruit to that plan and stick to that plan, a lot like what Nate Oates does in basketball that's worked so well. You have to have a plan and recruit to it and have players that fit what you want to do. Washington wants their offensive lineman apparently to be a little lighter, a little more athletic than what Alabama had in mind last year. But if Alabama was so wrong, you know, Latham's going in the first round. If Washington's so wrong, you know, they got their tackle going in the first round. So I think that's just an example of people shouldn't make too much of the differences. It all is fine. In the end, it comes down to just having a good player. And to me, whether Brockmeyer's 280, whether it's 295, as is being reported now, to me, it's just, you know, is he a good football player? Parker Brailsford did it at 275 and played at an all-conference level last year. So obviously, if you're at least that size, you can get it done.
Yeah, you can definitely get it done. And one of the things about the transition period for this offensive line is it's everybody. It's a new offensive system. So even the guys who you know you can bank on, the Tyler Bookers and the Jaden Roberts of the world right now, they're probably not where they need to be or want to be as far as their weight and how they're able to move based off of that weight. And so that's a work in progress, trying to adjust from going, you know, from a run first, run heavy, dominate the line of scrimmage, different style of blocking to, you know, having to switch up a lot of what it is that you do. Even those types of players who you know are going to be good, they're going through a transition period right now. So it's everybody. It's all five guys. There are some differences when it comes to what Alabama is doing defensively. That's going to cause some, you know, a transition period. But at the same time, you've got some veteran guys in that room, especially on the exterior and on the interior as well. It really is both. And they are, you know, sometimes it's just getting after the quarterback, and it's just nothing more than that. And they're kind of where they need to be as far as height and weight and things like that. It's a little bit different. I would expect the defense to be ahead of the offense right now, or at least in the trenches. So I don't think there's reason for major concern. Does that mean that you shouldn't have questions? No. I mean, I have questions. I have questions about a lot with the offensive line. Who's going to start at right tackle? Is Caden Proctor going to come in? Is he going to be focused? Can he earn the trust of his teammates back? What does his weight look like? You know, how quickly does it take him to adjust to this new offense? We talk about this transition period that everybody else is going through right now. He's going to have to go through it over the summer and into fall camp. So that's something to keep an eye on. You talk about that center position, whether Brailsford is back in the mix soon or he's not. The bottom line is that position's unsettled. So how does that end up playing, or how does that look? You know, that's something to keep an eye on. What does the depth look like? I really like the interior depth. I think they got some options there. The tackle depth, you know, what does Miles McVay look like? What does, you know, Betran look like? What does Elijah Pritchard, is he starting on the right side? Is it Wilkin Formby? What does everything look like? There are so many questions that you can have, but I don't think the questions at this point in early April should be cause for concern necessarily. It's really just an unknown, which is understandable. And I will say this too, Jimmy. We have said or predicted the offensive line was going to be really good, especially last year, and they weren't. So we're not above missing on this completely, but that was even coming from some very reliable sources. Everybody thought it was going to be good, and it wasn't. So just because we say it's everything's going to be good, great, and wonderful, and all this stuff looks great on paper, you still got to go out there and perform.
That's right. And at tackle in particular, you know, a little bit of a rant here. Don't come on A Day afternoon or A Day evening and rant and be all upset about, boy, that offensive line's terrible. They can't block the pass rush. It's going to be a long year. Why are you bothering posting that? Because the tackles on A Day are probably not going to be the tackles against Western Kentucky, or certainly not in that alignment. Alabama is not going to play this fall, probably, with the first team tackles that we see on A-Day. And I'll tell you where a real problem is going to be. You can sort of see this coming from a mile away, Clint. The front seven at Alabama is a pretty deep group. It's not just deep with talent. It's deep with guys who are experienced. I'll tell you, he's going to have a rough day. That second team tackle situation, I'm assuming, I don't know yet, but let's just guess that the second team tackles that day are, let's say McVay starts at right tackle. So with Pritchard on the left side, that means the second team is going to be Naquel Bertrand at left tackle and Wilkin Formby at right tackle. And there's your starting tackles on the number two offense. They're going to have to block people like LT Overton, Keanu Coot, maybe Damon Payne, you know, is going to be in that interior defensive line. So is maybe James Smith. That second team offensive line, and in particular the second team tackles, they're going to have to go up against not only some really good players, but some really good proven players that have played in SEC action and done pretty well. I think it could be sort of a bad day for that second team offensive line because, yeah, they're going up against twos, but the twos at Alabama have played in the games. So to say nothing of the problem that the ones will have, the ones aren't really going to be the ones in the fall. That's a prediction I'm making. Now, of course, Booker will be. Of course, Roberts will be. Maybe Brockermeyer will be. Maybe Pritchett, maybe. But if he is, he's probably going to be on the right side and not the left side, having to block Alabama's best pass rusher. I mean, Pritchett's probably matched up with Q Rob all day long. That's going to be a tough matchup for Pritchett against a fifth-year senior who's played with the ones.
Already seen it once.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what did DeBoer start talking about when the scrimmage was over? He's like, well, we had a tough time blocking the pass rush. That's probably what he was talking about. Probably.
Yeah,
was,
and I mean, last year,
that
too.
Pritchett
struggled. Because Dallas Turner and Chris Braswell were both out. Pritchett was the starter. Caden Pritchett was running with the twos. And, you know, both Q Robinson and, you know, Coat, both those two guys had a very successful A-Day.
We can sort of see that coming again. So right now, I mean, I would just encourage people not to freak out about the offensive tackles on A-Day because there's a lot to be determined there. And it starts with Proctor. I'll just leave that subject with this. I don't think I've ever said this before about a player, but because it doesn't sound right. But in this situation, I think it does. Caden Proctor has a huge summer coming. I mean, yeah, fall camp, of course. But summer is going to be big for Caden Proctor because I think in two ways he has to play catch up. This summer he's going to have to lose weight, I think, to get down to what the new staff would like him to see. So he's going to be working on his body a lot. This summer, while at the same time learning the offense, because I don't think it's going to be helpful for Proctor day one of fall camp to look up at the coach and go, okay, this is the call. Now, what do I do? he really needs to learn all that he missed this spring over the summer. A huge advantage he has, and it's one of the biggest assets Alabama has in its program, is Tyler Booker, who lines up at left guard. Tyler Booker can really help Caden Proctor with all he missed this spring. Booker's going to have to be sort of a summer coach, I think, as it relates to Proctor. Brockermeyer, too, who is also another coach on the field type. They're going to have to help Caden catch up, because Alabama's going to need Caden Proctor to nail down that left tackle spot, and they'll need him to be in shape, and they'll need him to know the scheme. Huge, huge summer for Caden Proctor. Can't wait till fall camp to hit the go button.
Yeah, I mean, and you're not bringing Caden Proctor back to sit on the bench. I mean, the expectation, he's got to earn it, and it's not just earning it on the field, it's earning it off the field and earning the trust of his teammates back and really getting back there and gelling with the new guys who have come in, you know, and maybe not at his position as much, but really just the offense in general, the roster in general, a lot of new faces, not a lot of new looks. And with where the tackle position is currently at, you can probably assume Alabama needs him to be a starter. I mean, he was a starter in the SEC. He's a very talented guy, but, you know, he's still got to earn that. And so once again, there's question marks. And you talked about that defensive front, and, you know, I find that interesting because it's kind of that there's some uncertainty, I guess, with your exterior pass rush, even though there's a lot of bodies. We like the talent that they have. I wouldn't say it's a concern whatsoever. It's just you're replacing Dallas Turner and Chris Braswell, you know, two of the best pass rushing tandem, exterior pass rushing tandem in all of college football last year. And so with that is going to come question marks, especially when it's a year removed from one of the best defensive players in program history heading out to the NFL. It's a lot of turnover at a critical spot in a 2-year period. And one thing, this is why Nick Saban was building up the depth and talent at that spot. It's why you saw all those different 5-stars. Some of those guys are going to be ready, in my opinion. It might not be the guys that you're expecting. You might see 5-star and think, oh, he's been in the system for a year. He's going to be ready to rock and roll. He's going to dominate. That might be the case. That might not be the case. At this point, once again, it's a little premature, but there's way too much talent in that room for Alabama not to be able to find at least 2, maybe even 3 players who can make an impact out on the edge. And when you're talking about that wolf position, it's just really 1. There will be some situational stuff occasionally, but from what I've seen, the Bandit, who is the kind of that heavy end build, he's playing on all 3 downs, and he's going to do some 2-point stuff, some 3-point stuff. And so you're going to see the Jordan Reynolds or LT Overton or Jamarian Latham. Latham might be a guy, I could see him being more situational, where he plays early on the edge and he moves inside in passing situations. If he ends up being that guy, I highly doubt they're going to have him bending the edge, you know, turning the corner on tackles on 3rd and long. I just don't think that's his skill set. I think he's got a little bit of that, and I think he can survive out there, kind of like Justin Aboigbe did. But I don't think that's really his game. But I think Overton, with his edge experience, with Renaud, his edge experience, Keon Keeley, that's another guy who is really designed for that position. You know, if he can hold up on, you know, as far as the run stopping stuff, but he's got a lot of work to do on the mental side of things and proving that he's got a good grasp of the defense and his responsibilities. But, you know, I think edge, we'll get to the interior defensive line, but for right now, those, whether it be Wolf or Bandit, there's a lot of options, Jimmy.
They do. Like I said earlier, when I was lamenting about what the offensive line might look like on A-Day, I was kind of bragging on that defensive line, because the defensive line and the linebacker group, frankly, good starters. Maybe, you know, it doesn't have a Dallas Turner out there. You know, he's going to be the first defender taken in the draft, most likely. But you have a bunch of good, proven players. The depth of options is great. And I'm real interested in what you said about, you know, Bandit under Saban on 3rd and long. You know, we'd kind of gotten a little used to lately seeing nickel or dime rabbits, you know, on 3rd and 10, 3rd and 12, when it's a definite passing situation. We saw 2 light guys on the outside, 2 true outside linebackers, Will I mean, for a while it was Will and Dallas, and then this past year it was Dallas and Chris Braswell on the field at the same time. It does appear to me, like to Clint, that bandit's not really coming off the field. It'd be 3rd and 10. I still think there'll be a bandit out there, but the point Clint brings up, and I hope that, or I would say I hope this is the case. I'm just curious as to what the case is. Like you said, right now it looks like Jamarion Latham is sort of your starter at bandit right now. I have a hard time believing that he's the guy there, though, on 3rd and 10, 3rd and 12. I think LT Overton makes a little more sense on the 3rd and long situations. Maybe even Keon Keeley by late in the year. Maybe it's LT early and maybe it's Keon later as he develops into a guy you can depend on. But I'm real curious as to how that's going to work. We've been doing it one way for 17 years, and now that's changing. But it is hard for me to imagine, Clint, that on the 3rd and longs, when we know the opposition is likely to throw it because they have 3 and 4 receivers in the route, it seems unlikely to me that we would have a 275-pound guy that's outside opposite the wolf.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of twitch to his game, you know, and that's something Nick Saban understood, the importance of having a lot of that twitch out there on the exterior when it's an obvious passing situation. And I say obvious passing situation, I mean 3rd and 6, 3rd and 7. You know, if it's 3rd and 10, if it's 3rd and 11, 3rd and 12, you know, I could see it being two wolves out there essentially. You know, I could see some packages where you will see two primary pass rushers. But if it's 3rd and 6 or 3rd and 7, you know, a guy like LT Overton, if the offense gets the first down and they choose to go hurry up, if you've got two wolves out there, then, you know, you might be stuck at a disadvantage because that other wolf is having to do some things as far as run stopping that isn't designed to do. But if it's 3rd and 6 or 3rd and 7, where you think you're going to be able to get that stop, you need to have sort of that twitch and that explosiveness off the edge. You need to be able to have a complementary exterior pass rush to your primary guy, which is going to be the wolf. Then, you know, if they do get the first down, you need to have somebody that's also out there to be able to hold up against the run. So you maybe have an LT Overton out there or a Jordan Renaud who has some of that run stopping ability, you know, maybe not to the degree that Jamarion Latham is, even though, and I've said this, I think Jamarion Latham still has some growing to do as far as his run stopping, you know, that aspect of his game. But from a body type standpoint and from a, you know, he's a year older, year in the weight room, kind of redesigning his body, will play a lot more out there on the edge. Should be easier to be a run stopper out there. You would expect probably some growth on that front, but just, you know, that's something that I'll keep an eye on. And I think others should as well. What does it look like on 3rd and 6 or 3rd and 7? And does that, you know, the percent chance of getting a first down, if it's 3rd and 10 or 3rd and 11, it drops significantly. So maybe if you're, you know, Womack and those guys, you're willing to take more chances as far as the personnel to give yourself the best chance to get off the field. But if you don't, you could find yourself in some tough situations. I find that fascinating. Something else I find fascinating, and we'll get to the interior. I want to talk about that as well, but I wanted to get your thoughts on this first. Under Nick Saban, it was a limited role, but you had that dime defensive back where really you had 5 primary starters who were playing a lot of snaps, but you had another spot where you could get another guy involved. Womack, from what we've seen, he's going to be going nickel, you know, that 4-2-5 pretty much exclusively. Doesn't really matter down and distance too much. There will be some rare situational stuff, but that's, you know, I would almost say that's your cheetah package. Like about as often as you saw the cheetah package in a game, you should be able, you know, you should be expecting anything other than nickel, maybe even less. But what that does say is in the past, whether it be Henry To'o, whether it be when he was healthy, Deontay Lawson last year, it was, you know, Jahad Campbell did it some when Deontay Lawson was out, but it was like you go look at the snap counts after the game and there was one linebacker who was playing 100% of the snaps or 99% of the snaps. They come off the field for one snap or something because something happened. Now, with it being that 4-2-5, you're going to have two guys who are playing close, if not 100% of the snaps. And I think based off of the strength of this Alabama defense, which is an inside linebacker, I think that kind of meshes pretty well, Jimmy.
It's a kind of a happy accident in that two guys that maybe now under the new scheme you never want to take off the field happen to be maybe the two best players on the whole defense. And hey, I'm a big believer. I mean, I know there's some guys on our board on the round table who are really good at explaining scheme and talking scheme. I enjoy those conversations a lot. I learn a lot, give a lot, and learn a lot, you know, from those conversations. But hey, I'm a dude guy. I'm a personnel guy. I believe in this, your best 11. That's what I believe in. Now, I won't take it too far. If your best 11 is seven defensive tackles, that's not going to help you out when you play, you know, somebody that spreads it and throws the ball a lot. I'm within reason. I'm about playing my best 11. That's why I was all for that nickel rabbit package 2 years ago that a lot of people were complaining about. I never complained about it because I wanted Will Anderson and Dallas Turner both on the field at all times. I never wanted to take one off for any reason. I thought they were both well-rounded players that could also play the run and weren't just pass rushers. And I never wanted to. To me, it was silly. Why do you take Dallas Turner off the field, who's going to be the first defender taken in the entire NFL draft? You take Dallas Turner off the field and put in a DB that's not going to get drafted. He's going to get cut in camp. And I got Dallas Turner sitting on the bench, and I got a DB out there that frankly isn't a great player. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. So I think the key for me schematically is it's a little bit of a happy accident. Now we're bringing in a guy who doesn't really take his two off-ball linebackers off the field. They're out there all the time. And it's Deontay Lawson and Jod Campbell, the two best defenders on the entire team, arguably. So I'm cool leaving them on the field, period. I know there are some matchups when it is a dime situation and the other team has put four or five receivers on the field. Those guys are going to have some drop responsibilities. They're going to make people nervous. But at the same time, they're great, great football players. And great players make great plays no matter the circumstance. So I think the personnel that Kane Womack inherited is largely fortunate. Largely fortunate that there's a lot of pieces here of guys who've played, who are talented kids. And I don't think he's doing a lot of, the square pegs trying to fit in his round holes. I don't think, well, that sounded terrible. But I don't think that's the issue here at all. I think most, I should have said round pegs and square holes. That's what I said. But we need to, besides moving on to a different subject, we need to recognize that Alabama has all these multiple guys that have played first team snaps and multiple. And who would have thought that he could? We have a brand new position, Bandit. Like, oh, no, this position calls for something that we've never really asked anybody at Alabama to do the last 17 years. But boom, Jamarian Latham's right there. LT Overton's right there. They're natural guys for the Bandit spot. To say nothing of a young guy like Jordan Renaud, who's another guy that it looks like we recruited him to play Bandit. So in that way, Kane Womack, I think, got a little lucky with what he inherited.
Yeah, and you know, for anybody wondering, for 2025, Alabama, I think, has eight commitments. Half of them are off-ball linebackers, and they're not done. And everybody's wondering, why are you hammered? Like, are you worried about that position? I do think that from a transfer perspective, you never know what's going to happen post spring, but you got to look. Deontay Lawson could be gone. Jahad Campbell could be gone. Justin Jefferson's going to be gone. You don't know what can happen as far as the transfer of some of these guys. So there, that's really, if it's not your top three, it's three of your top four, at least. And it's possible that guys could be back. So you don't want to assume, but I think it's a transition. On the flip side, I'll put it this way. The defensive backs, this kind of takes some strain off of them, because what happens? You've got five starters and you've got that sixth guy. But if a starter gets hurt, now that sixth guy moves into the starting role as a full-time starter, as one of those top five. Now you're working into your depth even more, because you've got to still have that sixth guy for when you do go dime and things like that. So there, you need to be deeper at that spot. And if you're not, it's a problem. Now you need to be deeper at off ball linebacker than you've been in the past. You know, it really, the last couple of years, Alabama has run three deep as far as they've had guys platooning, and they've had kind of a guy who has been an every down player. And so if a guy got hurt, it's like, man, you still got two guys that have been playing a ton, who know what they're doing, who you're confident in. It's no big deal. I think you might see that, but you probably won't. Not with Lawson and Campbell. But the depth becomes that much more important because you can't say, okay, Trez Marshall gets banged up or Deontay Lawson gets banged up. Okay, now we move Jahad Campbell into more of a full down role, you know, an every down role. And, you know, Trez Marshall, who had been platooning, now he's, you know, playing, you know, a huge chunk of the snaps, a much higher percentage of the snaps than he was previously. Really, it's, you know, you still have those two guys, but they're playing on every single down. So if you start working into that depth more, you've got a much bigger problem. With the defensive backs and the way that it's protected, that's now one less that you have to worry about, Jimmy. I think that's pretty critical, especially with the way that this roster is setting up, where you feel like it's going to be strong, at least the top, at off-ball linebacker. But also, if you're concerned about some of the depth with some of the young players in the secondary, this also helps them too.
Oh, no doubt. And, you know, I think it's the number one topic on the board lately has been, boy, they're taking in all these linebacker commitments. And what's up with that? There's too much concern, as usual. The concern would be if these guys weren't good players, but that they're all good players. And it's early in the cycle. And by the way, some of these guys are going to end up ranked higher than they are today, you know, over time. It's early in the cycle. But what Clint's saying, exactly right. Hopefully, everybody stays healthy, right? I mean, Jahad and Deontay, let's be honest. Jahad missed time last year, hurt. Deontay's missed a part of every single season, hurt. I mean, there hasn't been a season where Deontay hadn't been hurt. I hate saying that out loud, but that's just a fact. He's been hurt and missed games or missed time or played hurt in all three seasons he's been there. If he had been healthy the entire time, never missed any game, in my opinion, he'd probably be in the NFL right now, you know. But he's missed a lot of time, missed a lot of development for that reason. It's never been a full-time starter over the course of 13, 14, 15 games. Maybe you see that now. To me, you keep Jahad and Deontay healthy. Justin Jefferson, Clint's favorite. I like him too a lot. You know, I think you got him, break glass in case of emergency guy. I think Justin Jefferson might be pretty good. I see him being a big playmaker, frankly. But these young guys, you got to get them some snaps somehow, some way, just simply because you're assuming a lot if you're assuming Jahad and Deontay are going to stay healthy. So, because they haven't yet. But I think it's one of the more critical factors for this team. You do need to kind of stockpile at that position, though, because it is critical in this defense, because now you're not going to be subbing out. As Clint said, you used to go to dime. One of these linebackers had come off, replaced by a DB. Not going to be doing that anymore, apparently, or not nearly as much. So it's critical that you have a good core of linebackers, because you're going to be really more dependent upon that group than maybe you were in the past. In the past, you were taking one off, you know, for about 15, 18% of snaps, you know, that you're in dime. So, you know, in terms of the young players, I think next spring will be super interesting at inside linebacker, assuming Jahad and Deontay are off to the NFL, because you could have a lot of inexperience there, assuming 11-0 stay healthy all fall.
Yeah, and sort of just to kind of wrap up, the reason that off-ball linebacker is more important now, and it was always important under Nick Saban, it's always been your field general position. It will continue to be that. It'll be your green dot player. You know, we talk about headset communication. It's going to be an off-ball linebacker. It's going to be Deontay Lawson. Or if Deontay Lawson has to miss, it's probably going to be Jahad Campbell. But the point is that number two is now pretty much an every down player. He doesn't get opportunities where you can kind of protect him by taking him off the field and playing him more, not situationally, but, you know, the less snaps you have to play, the less that you can be exploited or exposed. Now, the stinger is every bit as important as the mic. Other than the communication factor, it's an every down player, and that's what makes an emphasis on that position bigger, on top of the fact that it's trying to head things off. And this is something that Nick Saban was always great at as far as the recruiting throughout the years. He was always thinking two or three steps ahead. and he was always prepared. I think that some of the things that he banked on later in his career, as far as the development of certain guys at certain positions, I think that started to trail off a little bit, where maybe some of the answers he thought would be answers by the time the problem arose were not able to be answers. And that created, you know, problems that didn't have answers. But, you know, I think that for the most part throughout his entire career, he did a very good job of heading some things off and making sure that everything continued to roll pretty smoothly. And so if you're Alabama, if you're Kalen DeBoer or Kane Womack or whoever, and you're looking at these off-ball linebackers, you see the importance, an increase in the importance of that position on top of the fact that you don't know what's happening post-2024, and you need to be ready for that. You can always turn to the transfer portal. That's great. But at the same time, if you already got some guys, a lot of bodies that you've brought in that you feel really good about, it's just one less thing that you have to worry about as far as trying to convince a transfer player to come in. So that's, you know, something to think about. As far as the interior defensive line, two positions, you know, you got the nose, you got the defensive tackle, you know, a little bit different, but at the same time, pretty much the same. But I mean, they're so deep, Jimmy. It's incredible. With the return of Tim Smith, Jaheim Otis has not been available this spring. So that's another guy who's a very good player. We expect to be an impact player in 2024. But you've got Tim Keenan, who proved that he was one of the better interior defensive linemen in college football last year. I thought he was incredible. You've got guys like Damon Payne, who have been very good rotational pieces, have actually shown some flashes as far as being more of a completed product than you would think. But, you know, still have some work to do in that area. But when you talk about rotational defensive linemen, Damon Payne would be starting, you know, at 95% of other programs. I'm telling you, he's a good player. But then you've got some other guys. You know, we talk about Tim Smith, but then you got Jamarian Latham as well, playing that bandit position. He can help you a little bit on the inside. You got James Smith, former five-star. We think he's going to take a big step forward. This is one of the deepest positions on Alabama's roster. And what I like the most about it is that we like a lot of the young talent, the Jeremiah Beamans of the world. You know, they've signed several who we like. Hunter Osborne is another one. Edric Hill is another one that they signed last year. Two guys who could end up taking a step forward. But my point is the balance between experience, loads of experience. Jaheim Otis, a two-year contributor, you know, part-time starter. Tim Keenan, been in the program several years. A lot of starts last year. You know, Tim Smith, ton of starts. Damon Payne has contributed the last couple of years. One of the most the best collections of both talent and experience and depth that Alabama's got on the entire roster. And it might be one of the better units in all of college football.
It really is. In terms of the depth, I challenge people all the time. I mean, show me a deeper room. Show me a room that's got more 5- and 4-star signees, maybe not as many fives as people would love to see, but, you know, more fours than anyone out there in college football. It's a really deep group. And I think ideally you have a Marcel Darius out there. You know, ideally you have a first-team All-American, a guy that could win the Outland Trophy as the best lineman in all of college football. Ideally you do. Okay, if you don't have that, what's the next best situation? Well, the next best situation is to have a bunch of guys who are really good. And that's what Alabama's got. I think the second best situation possible, which is a lot of guys who are really good. So you always have fresh legs. Someone's always fresh out there in the fourth quarter when the game's being decided. How valuable is that to have your 300-pound defensive lineman fresh? But when you've got for just two interior spots, Tim Keenan, Tim Smith, James Smith, Damon Payne, Jaheim Otis, five guys who are 300-pounders who have all played with the first team in big-time games in the past. That's not even to get to the newcomers, who some of whom, like you said, Clint, it could be that this spring Edric Hill is showing out. Could be a player like him or Hunter Osborne now that entering year two, they may be more ready. I don't know how much room there's going to be. You know, how much room at the end there is when you've got five guys for two positions. I tell you what, it's a big deal when Jaheim Otis has to miss the spring, Clint, but At the same time, Freddie Roach is like not lacking for options. That second team defensive line, by the way, like I said, they're going up against the second team offensive line, which is really all freshmen. They're going to murder that group, to be honest. I mean, probably. I mean, that's who my nickels will be on, is that second team defensive line. They're as good as many first team defensive lines, not just across the country, but in the SEC. It's a deep group of good players. Nobody get carried away. I'm not putting anybody in the first round just yet, but these are good football players.
Yeah, and that's the difference. Like Georgia, did they take a step back defensively last year? Yes. Did they still have one of the better defenses in college football? Yes. And I think that their defensive front was the perfect representation of the step back they took. But I think that Alabama's collective group of defensive linemen is much better than they had last year. I think they got a lot more talent, a lot more depth, a lot more impact potential from their group this year than Georgia did last year. And so that's kind of the point I'm trying to make, is that Georgia didn't have anybody that stood out. They didn't have any first-round talents along their defensive front last year like they did in the two previous years, but they still were pretty effective defensively. It just wasn't what it was the two previous years, and we have to acknowledge that. But, you know, you look at Alabama and what they have. They don't have to have any of the first-round dominant interior defensive linemen. You just need to get a collective group of experienced guys. And the other aspect of this that we're probably not talking about enough is, out of all the positions on the defense, this is the one that has the returning coach. And so you got all this returning talent combined with a coach that's familiar with him, that's already had relationships, that knows what he's going to get out of these guys. I think that's a pretty strong combination. And, you know, I think it's pretty important because, you know, your interior group, they're going to be asked to be complementary interior pass rushers, but the primary function is you need to be able to stop the run. And Womack, there's a reason he has a 275-pound bandit out there rather than having two wolf types as your two edge rushers. And it's that there is a primary emphasis on stopping the run, forcing offenses to be one-dimensional, and, you know, stopping the early down stuff to put them in unfavorable down and distances. And if you can do that, then you'll be a good defense if you have those complementary pieces. And so I think Alabama's interior defensive line is set up perfectly with the fact that you've got Freddie Roach coming back, and the fact that what their primary function is going to be, you have guys that could do that at an extremely high level.
Yeah, it's sort of this ultimate test. You know, Kane Womack has run this defense at Indiana. He's run it at South Alabama. Everywhere he's been the defensive coordinator, this has been what he's done. But yet, this is by far the most gifted group of athletes he's ever coached. And he's going up against, by far, the toughest schedule he's ever faced, too. It's all kind of relative, right? I mean, yeah, at South, they were really good defensively. They were really good. But they played South Alabama's schedule. You know, they're playing Sun Belt teams every week. How's it going to look? It's kind of the ultimate laboratory, right? I mean, now he's got these toys, these great athletes that he's plugging into a defense that he really believes in. But it's the ultimate test in terms of who you're facing week after week. The SEC has always been brutal. Now it's even more brutal that you're adding another top 10 programs to the league. And everybody's got to play one or the other. It is extremely difficult then throw in a road game against a Power 5 team like Wisconsin. And we're going to find out this year about Kane Womack's system, the swarm defense, the 3-3-5, you know, and we'll see. To me, it's all about the dudes. I mean, you can talk about whether it's a 4-2 or a 3-4, a stack, or whatever it is that you want to call it. To me, it's just about the dudes. If you recruit dudes and you got great defensive personnel, then you're probably going to be pretty good. And he's going to have that. So I'm really looking forward to what it looks like. I think A-Day is going to be really bland. I don't know that we're going to see a lot of situational stuff. I think it's just the starters, and they're going to leave them out there, both ones and twos. So I don't know, Clint, that we're going to come away from A-Day knowing exactly what Womack's defense is going to look like in the game schematically. We'll probably have to wait to Western Kentucky for that. But I am still very anxious to see at least the elementary building blocks of it.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at Womack, and I mean, he's been either been a defensive coordinator or a head coach for the last decade, right? Including a Power Five job at Indiana, playing in the Big Ten. It's not the SEC, in my opinion, but it's pretty darn close. He's never had one of Tim Smith on the interior of one of his defensive lines, much less four or five. And I understand that he's stepping up to the SEC, so he's never consistently played offensive lines as good as the offensive lines they're going to be playing, or a quarterback, or a running back, or whatever. But he's had success with lesser talent against lesser talent. And while he is taking a step up as far as the job and the responsibilities and the role and the pressure and all those things, I get it. He has access to more talent by a wide margin than he has ever had in his career. And he seems like he has a good head on his shoulders and a good grasp of how he's going to utilize that talent. And so, and he's going to have one of the best defensive minds to ever live in Nick Saban, whose office isn't too far away. I understand he's enjoying his retirement right now. I think that that's by design. I think that with this being Kalen DeBoer's first spring, Nick Saban doesn't want to be around breathing down his neck, even his presence in Tuscaloosa, whether he's trying to be involved or calling, or whether they're calling him, or just him being there, the perception of him still being around. I think that Nick Saban's trying to enjoy his life a little bit. He's done things a certain way for a very long time. And so I think he's getting to do that now. But on top of that, him getting to do some of those things is really him removing himself and letting this be Kalen DeBoer's show and King Womack's defense. But by the time that the summer rolls around and the fall and all those things, and you start getting closer to football season, and Nick Saban's not doing a whole lot of this stuff because he's getting in football mode too. He's doing the commentating thing. He's got to know what's going on. He's got to keep up. He'll be doing film study and all that. That's not going to stop. So once he gets into that mode, you know, I think you'll be able to pick his brain a little bit more than they already have. And I think that, you know, when you talk about that, I think Womack's in a great position to succeed compared to, you know, he's been successful pretty much everywhere he's been. But the reason I think that continues is that combination of factors that I just mentioned.
Oh, absolutely. And boy, it sure is interesting to know what input Nick Saban will have, if any. Again, Kalen DeBoer refers to him as a resource. I mean, that's his most often term. And Kane Womack has reached out and met with Coach Saban and tried to, you know, coach him up on, hey, this is the scheme we're using and this is the terminology we're using, and I want you to know that so we can have conversations. I mean, you can tell Kane Womack wants to have in-depth conversations with Nick Saban about his defense and use Nick Saban probably in the way he's always used his father, who basically was the author of the defense that Kane Womack has installed and used his whole career, sort of invented by Dave Womack and his people, his friends. And I'm sure Kane has always used his dad as a sounding board. Now he's got the opportunity to use Nick Saban as a sounding board. To me, it's super interesting, that balance, because you don't want to wear Saban out. You also don't want to involve him to the point that he's always there, because, you know, that can be sort of disruptive. I'll say it on our show. I'm not sure how Florida fans handle it, but it seems to me that Steve Spurrier being sort of aggressive about Billy Napier at times and sort of being critical about Napier in the media, I know Florida fans enjoy that because they're critical of Napier, but I'm not really sure it's helping Florida get better. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't know that Nick Saban being omnipresent is a great plan, but Nick Saban being a resource, as Kalen DeBoer says, and being supportive and hey, you got a question? I'm happy to give you my two cents if you have a question, but I'm not going to be knocking on your door giving you my opinion unless it's asked for. That's, I think, Jimmy, in Jimmy's opinion, that's the way to do it, is Saban's there as a resource. He's there when asked, but I'm not sure it would be maybe a little more destructive if he was literally had an office in the football building and was at the defensive staff meetings. I don't really think that's very helpful. This has to be Kalen DeBoer's program, or it's just simply not going to work.
Yeah, completely agree. Yeah. And I mean, there will be enough opinions in that room already, whether it's offense or defense. I mean, you just look at it. Brian Ellis takes over for Nick Sheridan as the tight ends coach, former Georgia Southern offense coordinator, quarterback coach, has that passing background as an offensive play caller. Kalen DeBoer, former offensive coordinator, former play caller. Nick Sheridan, former offensive coordinator. Jamarcus Shepherd has been a co-offensive coordinator. Coach Cap has been a run game coordinator and a co-offensive coordinator before. You look at the defensive side with Kane Womack, former head coach, former defensive coordinator. Mo Linguist, former head coach. So he might not have that defensive coordinator experience necessarily, but he's got the bird's eye view from a head coach's perspective. Hitchler, former defensive coordinator. So many guys who you don't rise to that occasion and earn that job without being innovative and creative and bringing something to the table, whether it be as a play caller or earning the title of a co-defensive coordinator. Because if you're not going to be the play caller, you need to be bringing something else to the table to have that role. And that is good, innovative ideas. That's having a trusted defensive mind or a trusted offensive mind. And Alabama's coaching staff, whether it be on offense or defense, is just littered with guys who have that input ability. Some people might say, is it too many opinions? I don't think so. I think Kalen DeBoer is going to do a good job of managing this. I think he's going to listen to people. I think that's one of his gifts, and that's one of the reasons he's been successful, whether it be listening to his players, listening to his assistants. Nick Saban always did that. You know, he understood that he had the final say-so with everything, but he listened to people, and he wanted their input, and they would have coaches' meetings, and they would sit down, and he would say, all right, let's talk about some of these things. Let's vote on things. I want to know where this coaching staff stands. I think that that's kind of going to be the approach of Kalen DeBoer. He's going to be the final or have the final say. But you've got a lot of, I mean, when they're trying to figure out how they're going to attack Georgia's defense in week four, they're going to have a lot of offensive minds who have input and ideas, and they might see something on tape that no one else noticed or saw. I think that is crucial, whether it be on offense or defense. And I think that just, you know, when you talk about the defensive side, it might not have as many of those guys, but you know, you've got Nick Saban that's not too far away, who's probably going to be looking over some things himself, and just give him a call on a weekly basis. Hey, do you see anything? Do you notice anything? Yeah, I saw this, or I noticed this. I think that that's so beneficial. And as long as it's managed or handled correctly, it could be something that we've really never seen before with the coaching staff. Just with all the experience as far as being a head coach, a play caller, or a co-coordinator.
And there's nothing you can get accomplished more with a good organization if the organization operates almost like a think tank. I mean, you know, need everybody's thoughts and a pitch behind those thoughts. And then the boss, in this case, Kalen DeBoer, makes a decision and goes with it. Having Nick Saban as that resource on the defensive side of the ball is just incredibly helpful. So is having a tight end that was an OC and the quarterback coach. Of course, the OC now has been an OC in the past. And you know, Shepherd at wide receiver, he's gonna be an OC probably in the future somewhere. And of course, Coach Cap, an extensive amount of experience. So on the offensive side of the ball, you've already got those guys. I know I'll throw this. Saw today that John McNulty is being rehired by Alabama as an analyst. He was an analyst on last year's team as well. For those unfamiliar with him, here's a guy who's been a longtime NFL offensive coach. In the league several years, even pension eligible, I'm sure, or however that works, but also has been an OC at Rutgers and Boston College, quarterback coach at the college level, wide receiver coach at the college level, tight end coach at the college level, and has coached those positions in the NFL. So he's a wealth of football X's and O's stuff on the offensive side of the ball, serving as an analyst. So Alabama's not going to be short for opinions or for resources. It's just a matter of the head coach making the right call. And hey, it's a lot of difficult calls because it's a difficult job, partly because of the demands, but mostly because of who you play. I don't think we talk about it enough. It's always been brutal. It's about to get worse. It's like the NFL. I mean, we're closing in on a time, Clint, where 9-3 is a heck of an achievement. We're closing in on that. It used to be 9-3 was a reason for some fans to want to send a moving van to the coach's yard. We're moving up on 9-3 being give that man an extension. We're getting there.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy how things have changed. And you know, the last thing I'll say before we hop out of here, I believe in Nick Sheridan. I think he's going to be a pleasant surprise as an offensive coordinator, mostly because Kalen DeBoer is going to have a huge input. And we know that Kalen DeBoer is established and he can be trusted on that front. I think the game plans will be there. They just got to be executed. And, you know, I think that DeBoer having some input and the fact that him and Nick Sheridan already have that trust factor, this isn't like it's a new guy that you're bringing in. This isn't Jimbo Fisher bringing in, Bobby Petrino to be his offense coordinator. You're like, how are those personalities going to mesh? Sheridan has worked for DeBoer for forever. He's been his offense coordinator before. And so, or he's been an offense coordinator when DeBoer had left. But the point is that there's familiarity there. And, but what I will say is that if for whatever reason it doesn't work out, I think you got a guy in Brian Ellis who would be the automatic guy who you would look at to take over those duties. And he's got offense play calling experience. He's got that passing background. I mean, he had Georgia Southern slinging the football around and having a very high level of success. You know, so I think that just, you know, heading things off, making sure that you've got a fallback option in place. I think that, you know, DeBoer might have one, but at the same time, I say that to bring that up to ease the minds of fans. But I also want to reiterate, I still believe in Nick Sheridan and I think he's going to get the job done.
No, I've said this before and it means to be as objective as possible. Nick Sheridan does not have a resume that merits him being the offensive coordinator at Alabama. I know that's brutal. That's not a very, you know, something that somebody might expect me to say out loud, but I'm just being honest when I say, when you look at his resume and what he's accomplished as an offensive coordinator, it does not compare to even Tommy Reese, to say nothing of Steve Sarkisian and Lane Kiffin and other guys who have held that position. His resume doesn't merit it, but I could not be more excited about Nick Sheridan, because to me, again, I'm a recruiting guy. I'm into dudes. Nick Sheridan's a dude. He just hasn't done it yet because he hasn't been handed the keys to a Ferrari yet. That's why he hasn't done it yet. He's never been in this position. But if you ask me, Jimmy, who might be a great offensive coordinator? I would say someone that works for Kalen DeBoer and runs DeBoer's offense, someone who played quarterback position at a high level for a big school, someone whose dad was in the business for 40 years and he learned up growing up in a coach's house, no different than Kane Womack. That's Nick Sheridan. Bill Sheridan, his father, extremely well-traveled, highly successful college assistant coach. He needs to be smart. Have y'all heard Nick Sheridan talk? I mean, he's 200 IQ. Smart, likable. And Kalen DeBoer, regardless of what anybody might say, I would argue Kalen DeBoer groomed. The last OC he groomed is now the OC for the Seattle Seahawks. I think Nick Sheridan is going to be great. And I say that after admitting he doesn't even have a resume that merits him having this job. But I have myself zero concern. I think Sheridan's going to be great. I think he's been handed the keys to a Ferrari, and I think the guy grew up knowing how to drive one.
I could not agree more. I mean, just, you know, it's kind of like, you know, what helped Aaron Rodgers probably more than anything in his career? It's that he started his career playing behind Brett Favre, and he had to sit for several years. What helped Jordan Love this past year becoming the starter was the fact that he spent several years, way more years behind the scenes, learning behind Aaron Rodgers than your typical quarterback. You know, you look at Phillip Rivers and him sitting behind Drew Brees like he did for a while until Drew Brees was a free agent. That helped him. It's like Nick Sheridan has been sitting and learning while still being hands-on, being a position coach, but he's been working with Grubb and with DeBoer for a long while. And he's been, you know, I'm not saying that the design was for him to be groomed to take over for Grubb, and that was the, you know, always the expectation. But I will say they didn't do a whole lot of outside looking, you know, as far as when that decision was made. It was almost like they are, in fact, there was reports that they kind of had a plan in place already ready to go. And so Sheridan might have been the expectation. And a guy like Jamarcus Shepherd, one of the best personalities I've ever had the chance to be around, when that guy's talking, it's like he's talking directly to you and only to you, even though he's speaking in a room full of media. Like, that's a gift. There's a presence about him. And so I think those two guys working in unison with this offense, along with Kalen DeBoer, I don't think fans should have any concerns at all. Jimmy, do you have anything else before we decide to hop out of here?
Nope, just fired up nine practices now down. I think just six to go, with the 6-1 being A-Day scrimmage this weekend. We're in the meat of it. I'm really excited. Got some football fever. And then right after spring practice is over, me and Clint, we're going to talk you to death about the NFL draft. And then when the NFL draft is over, we'll have less than 100 days till fall camp starts.
Yeah, I mean, that's I can't wait to get that stuff going, man. I can't wait to do some reaction stuff to A-Day. You see everybody live in a game-like situation where it's guys lining up. There could be some situational stuff that's not the same, like how often are they bringing blitzes. I don't know. I don't know how DeBoer ran things at Washington. I know that Nick Saban changed some things up as far as that, you know, on that front this past spring. But it's going to be fun to watch. It's going to be more of who's lining up where on the offensive line. How often is Pritchett playing left and getting some right looks? Is it exclusively left? I would expect left only, just, you know, if you're wondering. But, I mean, you know, maybe they play him a little bit on the right and you're like, oh, they are getting him some reps, and we get to react to that. How does Wilkin Formby look? How does, you know, who ends up being the starter? Is it exclusively James Brockermeyer if Parker Brailsford is still, you know, handling some things or dealing with some things off the field? Whatever ends up happening, we're going to be reacting to all of it. It's going to be fun. This has been fun, Jimmy, diving into the weeds a little bit, talking. We're going to be doing it again this week. This isn't our only video. We're going to be hammering it because you got that first scrimmage coming up, and Travis is going to continue to do his thing. Thursday and Friday, I believe, they're going to have some more video content for you guys. So certainly be on the lookout for that. Certainly, you know, head on over to the Roundtable message board. Sign up. It's only a dollar right now. Take advantage of that March Madness deal going on at Bama Online. Only a dollar. Get in on those conversations regarding Alabama in the Final Four. First ever. Great conversations happening on that front, but it's also spring football. It's also NFL draft. Jimmy, there is a ton going on. And I think that, you know, if you're going to join in on the conversation, why not now? So definitely do that. Definitely like this video, subscribe to the Bama Online YouTube channel. We got a lot of video content coming out. There's going to probably be a video every single day this week leading up to that scrimmage. And there's going to be a ton of reaction to it as we get information, you know, some nuggets for you guys post scrimmage. So Jimmy, as always, I appreciate you and I appreciate you hopping on. Need to sneak in some of these remaining tournament games, including Alabama in the Final Four? Well, Prime Video has you covered. Watch every game live on your phone, on your laptop, or relax at home and watch on Prime Video with a subscription. Prime Video gives you choices to add on channels like Paramount Plus and Max, both of which have been featuring NCAA tournament games, all in one place. It's March, it's Madness. Stream it all now on Prime Video.